Hi, I'm Patrick, and I'm an alcoholic addict. So I was driving back from L.A. From work, and Steve texted me, and I really didn't read the text very clearly, and I just said yes. And I didn't even really know what it was. And then I got home a couple hours later, and I looked at it, and I went, oh, crap, I just agreed to do this. So here I am. Yeah, so hold on, 40 minutes, there we go. Is that too loud?
No.
All right. You barely hear me? Really? All right. Wow, that is loud. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm pretty certain everybody here knows what it was like. There may be some differences, you know, slight differences here. One of the things, for me, I grew up here in Ridgecrest. I was actually born in Trona, which may explain a lot. But yeah, so I was born in Trona, but grew up here in Ridgecrest. I'm the youngest of four kids. There's 7 years difference between me and my next eldest sibling, which means I was kind of an oops baby. And I kind of was I'm the youngest, so I was kind of not the, all right. Well, my siblings would all say I was spoiled rotten. I would say I just got what I deserved. But yeah, I was spoiled rotten. And my dad was a game warden here. My mom taught kindergarten. And I had a really loving family. I was really fortunate to have them. I got to go patrol with my dad all the time out in the desert and go hunt and fish. And my mom was a kindergarten teacher, so she encouraged, you know, me to read and things like that when I was younger. But my older siblings were all very, very successful. One of my sister, Molly, graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Berkeley, skipped a grade in high school. My other siblings all got straight A's. And then I came along, and that all just seemed like too much work. And I figured, well, they're so great, why even try? And so I didn't. I went to St. Anne's School here in Ridgecrest. I was blessed to be able to be taught by nuns. And I got I did all right. I got C's, I think, and things like that in school, but I didn't want nothing special. Going to St. Anne's, nobody really ever talked about drugs. There were some mentions of alcohol in the 7th and 8th grade, but it really wasn't talked about a whole lot. But at my house, my parents were very normal drinkers, but they would drink Red Mountain wine out of the big garland jug with the twist-off cap. And I remember as a kid, I would start sneaking this wine just to drink it because I wanted to feel like I was a grown-up. Same thing with the cigarettes, and I really, really liked the effect. It really felt freeing for me. I just felt good. And it was almost then that I decided that that was my life's goal, was to feel good. And anything that required effort or work did not feel good, so I wasn't gonna do that. I graduated from St. Anne's as like a solid C student. I went to Burroughs the next year and was introduced to a green leafy substance, which became my best friend. I loved that. It was the one thing that I felt that I was really, really good at. I could drink and I could do drugs with the best of them. And I was good at it. And it was the one thing that people accepted me in. I wasn't a jock. I was too uncoordinated. I wasn't a student where I could do anything, you know, study or anything like that. I didn't do the drama thing or any of the clubs at school, but I could get loaded. And I did. And I kind of grew up in the time, too, you know, when people would talk about, you know, I'd watch, I'm going to date myself, but I'd watch, like, Dragnet and Adam 12, and they'd always talk about people smoking joints and jumping off a roof because they think they could fly. And I found out all that was bullshit. And so I figured, well, if that's bullshit, everything else must be bullshit. So I'm going to take everything I can take and see what I can do. I barely graduated from Burroughs. My grades went from a C to an F's and D's. My mother was the queen of denial. She couldn't believe that her little baby boy would be doing drugs, so she had my IQ tested. Apparently, she thought I got struck stupid in my freshman year. But she would never believe that I was doing that sort of thing. But all I could think of growing up here was to get the hell out of Ridgecrest. That's all I wanted to do, was to get out of Ridgecrest. So I joined the Navy, like a good Ridgecrest kid does. And I wanted to join the Navy to see the world. And the closest I got to a boat was I rented a canoe from Special Services one time and paddled around a pond. And I got sent to Washington, D.C. for my whole four-year hitch. And while I was in D.C., I met a girl, and that girl did IV drug use. And because I realized that everything everybody has ever told me about drugs was bullshit, must be bullshit about that too. So we started doing that. And in the Navy back in 1980, drinking was mandatory. It was mandatory. You drank. And again, I did it very, very well. It was one of the few things that I felt made me popular, made me look better than everybody else I thought, or look good. It enabled me to talk to girls, which I couldn't do if I was like sober. So it just opened up all these worlds. And you know, the thing of it is it was fun. I had a lot of fun. You know, I hear people talk about, I've heard somebody say, you know, my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. And I'm like, dude, I don't even think you were doing it right. Because that ain't even close for me. But while I was in the Navy, again, I thought I was clever, thought I was smart, and I was going to get in trouble. I knew I was going to get caught for drugs. So at the time, they had a deal where if you cop to it, they would didn't kick you out. They'd send you to counseling, which is what they did. But I didn't stop, and I knew I was going to get out, and I thought that I didn't have to put up with the BS that the Navy threw at me when I went into the civilian world. And I said, I smoke pot, and I'm going to smoke pot till the day I die, and there's nothing they could do about it. Well, there was something they could do about it. They invited me to leave the Navy, which I did, and I got out. You know, I got a general discharge under honorable conditions, but right at the bottom of my DD-214, it says misconduct due to drug abuse. And I thought that was pretty funny. I thought I was pretty proud of that. Except around my dad. I was ashamed of my parents. But I got out of the Navy, and I continued on with the path that I had chosen. And I did it really, really well. I did it for a long time. I moved to Alaska. I went to Alaska, I commercial fished, I did all these things. I lived in a little plywood and visqueen shack out in the forest. I was homeless, drinking and partying, and just living the life, I thought. I went to school, I somehow got a degree, got a job with the Forest Service, stole a significant amount of drugs from somebody who apparently didn't appreciate it, and was looking to hurt me, so I left Alaska rapidly, went back to California, run to mommy and daddy, because that's what I'd always do. I'm a user. I used chemicals, I used alcohol, and I used people. And I did I was a very good manipulator. Whenever I needed money or anything like that, I'd call mommy and daddy. And mom would always come through, or my family. I came back to California, and I think it was 1987 or 86, I got caught. I did something very, very terrible to a family member, and I was invited. I was told I could either talk to the police or I could go to rehab. Those are my choices. And I go for the easier, softer way. I thought rehab, 30-day vacation, I'll get my tolerance back. I get out of, I avoid trouble. I'm gonna go to rehab. So I went to rehab, New Beginnings in Long Beach. Steve, shout out. Went to New Beginnings, came out of that, came back to Ridgecrest. First place I went to the Alano Club, which, by the way, I thought was an Irish bar. But when it first went up. But I went to the Alano Club, I went in, I shared about being an alcoholic and an addict, and then I was invited by a gentleman at the end of the table that there was another fellowship in town that I would be better suited for. So I went to that fellowship. And I'm so grateful for that man, because that fellowship and I owe a huge debt of gratitude toward Narcotics Anonymous. Because I'll tell you, at the time I walked into those rooms, there were 10 or 12 people there. Everybody gave me a hug. You never got out of the room without a hug. And it was a 12-step fellowship, and it really saved my butt at the time. And I went and decided to become a drug and alcohol counselor because I wanted to know all the answers. And I thought they were cool, and I thought that they could probably get girls. Which apparently that's frowned upon in that field too. But anyway, so I went and I did that, and I studied for that, and I did, and you know, shockingly, when I stopped drinking and doing drugs, I wasn't bad at school. I couldn't believe it. And I did okay. And I moved to Tahoe. And like I said, I was a drug and alcohol counselor. I knew all the answers. I could tell you exactly how to live your life. I could tell you, I mean, and I had the best advice. I was on point. But I didn't know how to live my life. And like I said, I got into the 12-step program. I got a sponsor, not because I wanted one, but because everybody said I should have one. And I want to please everybody, so I got one. My first sponsor, some of you people would know him, Mark Penry. Mark P, he used to be here. And but I didn't do any of the step work. I think I got to step five, through step five, and did that in Tahoe. Moved around, I was kind of a gypsy. I went back to Alaska for a long time. But the thing of it is, I stopped going to meetings. And I stopped doing what everybody tells me I needed to do. So I'd stopped going to meetings. I had 10 or 11 years clean. I got married, finally met a woman. And this is me. I am a people pleaser to the nth degree. I don't want anybody mad at me. I don't want anybody not to like me. I want everybody to like me. That's very important for me. I don't want to disappoint anybody, even though that was basically my life story up to that point. But I didn't want to disappoint anybody. I met a woman online, and I was in California, and she was in Florida. And we got to talking on the phone, and we had all this in common. We talked, you know, it was one of those things where we'd sit there and talk all night. I'd send her a picture of myself. This is back in the day of MySpace and whatever. She would never send me a picture of herself. It was a woman, by the way. I just, all right. And that was kind of a, and because I'm impulsive, after talking with her for probably 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, I asked her to marry me over the phone. You know, hey, why not? And so like a month later, I still hadn't got a picture of her or anything like that. So I got in a plane in California. I flew out to Florida. I was going to be there. Now, this is the important part. I was going to be there for a week. And I didn't really have a whole lot of money to stay anywhere else, so I was going to stay with her. She's picking me up at the airport. I step out of the airport. She comes driving up in a Ford Explorer with big Mickey Thompson mudders on it. And I'm like, okay. But I could barely see her over the steering wheel. It was like that. And I'm like, oh, she's a tiny little thing. We get to her house, she gets out of her car, and she comes up to my hip. And she had a large kind of a hump on her back. She had spina bifida. She was born with spina bifida. And she was on crutches. She had a bad left leg. And I can remember I went, wow, you're really short. Now I'm 6'3", all right? And immediately I'm like going, okay, I don't know how am I going to get out of this. And I didn't have any other place to stay, or nor did I have the money, and my ticket wasn't good until the next week. So I married her. You know, I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to be the disappointment. I didn't want to be, you know, what an asshole, you know. Plus, I didn't want to be kicked out in the street and sleep where they fucking have alligators and shit out there. All right, so I went ahead and married her. And the thing about that was that I thought I knew about love. I thought I did. You know, I thought I was all about that hot, you know, that passion, that, I don't know, that burning thing, that just, you know, that thing. And what I learned from her was that it wasn't that at all. It was something really, really quiet, really gentle, peaceful. And this poor woman had such a horrible, horrible life. Her dad and mother were incredibly abusive to her. Her dad strangled her cats to death in front of her. They abandoned her when she was 13. She's been very mistreated. And so I had made it a point in my head that I'm going to treat her the way she should have been treated. And I really worked hard at it. And one of the few things in my life that I am really kind of proud of is how that marriage went with me and her. And it wasn't easy, and there was problems and everything else like everybody else has. But at the time, I wasn't using. But the thing of it was all the physical defects that she had chronic pain, legitimate chronic pain. And she took legitimate chronic pain medication. And whenever I would have a neck ache, or a backache, or a headache, she would say, oh, let me give you a cocktail. And again, being a very amenable guy, I'm like, sure. And so she'd mix me up something with a couple of Darvocet and a couple of Soma, you know, and things like that. And I'd take that, and boy, I kind of enjoyed that. And now I'm like going, I'm having a headache and a backache when I don't have a headache and backache. And now I'm going into her bathroom and stealing her necessary pain medication for myself. Now, this is back in the 2000s. Then I decided, oh, my neck hurts. I'm going to go to a doctor. And this is when they were throwing all the pain medication at you. And so I went to the doctor. They started, this is the kind of addict alcoholic I am. I've had 3 neck surgeries and I didn't need any one of them. I did all of them for the pain medication. And I became very addicted, but my wife, Beth, kind of kept me in check. She would give me my pain medication. What she knew that she was giving me. There were times when I'd steal it, but for the most part, she kind of kept me in check. I lost basically every job I had, and I had good jobs. I had lost all my jobs, and then Beth got sick. She had her own business, and then she got really sick. She had osteomyelitis in her left leg. It transferred to her right leg. She had to get her leg amputated and taken off. I took care of her during that whole time. But she lost her business because of my addiction. I couldn't hold a job, and we lost our home, and we were 15 minutes from being homeless. We were staying in a hotel at the generosity of a church. This is back east in Abington, Virginia. And my sister, again, I called my family one more time and threw myself on their mercy. And my sister from Alaska flew us out to California. My sister here, Peggy, rented us an apartment, me and my wife, and put us up in this apartment. And I had lost my car. I never had a car. I hadn't had a job for a long time. And this whole addiction thing was getting to be problematic. You know, it's hard to keep the amount of pills that I needed, keep them going. And I drank occasionally. I did think that I could drink because obviously back, you know, when I first went to AA, you know, that was young. I was 27. It was probably just a phase. You know, I'm sure I can drink now. And I've never done anything, any drug or any alcohol, without the express intent of getting high on it. That's just the way it is. So anyway, we moved out here. We came back to California. She hated it, but she was here. And she would sit on the floor all the time because she couldn't, had a hard time getting on bed because she only had one leg and she couldn't wear a prosthetic. And during that time, she one day complained to me and said, look, I got a little sore in my bottom. Can we stop and get a donut at Walmart so I could sit on? So I did. And she never used it. And then she got sicker and sicker and sicker. She would get sepsis so bad that she would shiver and her teeth would chatter and chips would fly off her teeth. And I would lay on her trying to keep her warm. And anyway, she'd get sicker and sicker, and I keep telling her to go to the doctor, and she hated doctors. She didn't want to go to the doctor. Finally, I told her, look, I'm going to call the police. I'm going to call an ambulance. I'm going to call somebody, but you're going to the doctor. So I finally got an ambulance, convinced her to go to the doctor. She went to the ER here in Ridgecrest. And when they checked her out, that little sore in her bottom turned into be a bed sore that was so deep her bladder and uterus were falling out of her body. And she was so septic from the mess back there and everything else. Put her in Ridgecrest Community Hospital. They dumped the antibiotic. They put a PICC line in, dumped the antibiotics to her, and actually got her better. And the only time I really ever, well, I wouldn't say it's the only time, but the times that I'm really ashamed of was when she would be there really, really sick. She would be so sick she couldn't even see. And I would steal her pills out from under her, her pain medication. But that's where my addiction was leading me. And then she was in Ridgecrest Hospital. They wanted to do a colonoscopy, you know, to help her heal. And they did that. And then that night she was laying there and she was in a lot of pain after it. And she wanted me to stay, but I needed to get home because I knew my pills were at home. I said, I'll see you tomorrow. And the next morning I got a call at 6 a.m. saying she had coded and passed away. And I remember, this is again where my addiction led me, is that when I was at the hospital saying goodbye to her body as she laid in the hospital bed, I looked at the wall and there was a Demerol pump on the wall. And I was, had my knife out trying to get the Demerol out of there. But anyway, once she had gone, all bets were off. And I didn't care. I was drinking, I was using. There was no limits anymore to me. There was nothing holding me back. And I went down, and I went down fast. I was probably, there's a couple people here who saw me back then and know where I, where that led me. But just to say, suffice it to say, it wasn't good. And because I'm a veteran, I was able to eventually, when I finally, I had a friend of mine come back to Ridgecrest, who had also been using, who had also relapsed, but decided that they were going to get clean again and kind of encouraged me to do the same. And that's what I did. And then I called this veterans hotline and they got me into a rehab within the next day or so. And again, this is the kind of manipulator I am. It was a hospital-based program, and the first thing I had to do was go talk to a doctor. And the first thing I did when I went and talked to that doctor was convince that doctor he needed to prescribe me pain medication. And I'm there for that. And luckily, I didn't do it. And then while I was there, I heard of a place called Veterans Village. Now, when I went to boot camp, I went to boot camp in San Diego. And across the street from San Diego, there was a hotel called the Pink Hotel. And you were told during Liberty, after boot camp, do not go to that hotel, is off limits. It's nothing but hookers and drugs, which of course was very attractive for all the sailors. And it was nothing, and that's what it was. It was just this really bad, bad place. Well, some Vietnam veterans wound up buying that hotel and turning it into Veterans Village, which I love the irony on that. That just worked out really well. And so I went from the hospital-based month program and I went to the Veterans Village. And it was just an amazing place. And it's closed down, unfortunately, now. I don't know why, but it's sad. But I started getting clean. This was about 7 or 8 years ago. I came back to Ridgecrest, and I've had my relapses. And I'm not going to call them slips, because there's no way I slipped and fell into a bottle. I never slipped and slipped with a bunch of pills into my mouth. I never slipped. I relapsed. I made a decision to use. The last time I thought perhaps, just perhaps, I could do California sober. Maybe, just maybe, you know, I really like, and I know it comes as a shock to a lot of you, but I really like weed. And I thought, well, if I could just do weed, I'll be okay. Because I have this pain in my back, and it helps my back, and all this other bullshit. And I started doing that, and it was fine. And mind you, in all the years that I used and drank and did the stupid crap that I did, I only got arrested once, and that was outside of JD's for fighting in public. For those of you who know where JD's was. That's the only time I ever got arrested. I never caught a DUI. I never caught a drug charge. And that's because I was such an ineffective drug user and dealer that nobody was even interested in me. So anyway, I decided I could smoke some weed. And so I was. And then I wondered, well, gee, I wonder how my old drug dealer's doing. And I went and checked on him. And he was doing fine. He was doing good. And he actually still had some stuff. So next thing I know, I started smoking that other stuff again. And of course, when I smoke that other stuff, I get a drink, because I'm a chemical engineer. I like to keep things level. And so I had drank a pint of vodka. I had smoked a bunch of this stuff. I had run out of everything. So I went and I got another pint of vodka, and I went and I got another bunch of stuff. And I had it in my pocket, and I had the pint of vodka in the seat of my truck. And I'm driving home, and all of a sudden, bloop, bloop, I get lit up in the back. And I'm like, I pull over, and I just shook my head, and I go, okay, here you are. Good job. I was like 58, 59 years old. And yeah, good. I'm going to catch my first drug charge and my first DUI. Good job. Go for the trifecta here, you know? And the cop comes up to the window, and I forgot all about the stupid pint in the seat next to me. And he looks in the window, and he's like, oh, you've been drinking tonight? And I'm like, oh, no. And he's like, and I'm lit. And he's like, well, let's just step out of the car and check. So, all right. So I step out of the car, and he does his little sobriety check on me. And he goes, no, okay, you're good. He goes, you can get back in the car. I just pulled you over because your trailer hitch was blocking your license plate. But you can go on home. Just ask, because you had that pint in the seat. And I'm like, and I swear to God, I almost said, are you sure? Like, I didn't. And I went home, and again, not being wasteful, I did what I had, but that was 4.5 years ago, September 21st, I haven't had anything since, any mood or mind-altering chemicals. But here's the thing, and this is the gist of what I wanted to say, is that I'm 63 years old, soon to be 64, and in all of that time, I never, ever grew up. You know, people say that the good name for AA would be grow the fuck up. And I don't know about y'all, but I know what that is really, really true for me. And I didn't want to grow up. I never paid bills. Every apartment I've ever had was a pigsty. Except when I was married to my wife. I never did anything. I never took care of anything. The last place that my sister rented for me, I destroyed. I literally destroyed it. Cost her $2,000 or $3,000, probably more, to fix it up after I was kicked out of it. Never did that. And like I said, I'm 4.5 years clean and sober. And this last January, I made some decisions, one of which was that, and I was living with my sister again, because I'm that brother. You know, I think almost every family has the ne'er-do-well, you know, the one that everybody kind of has to put up with and help and kind of feel sorry for, everything like that. That was me. And I was renting a room for my sister, and God bless my sister. She is just an amazing, amazing woman, and that I could never repay her, ever. I got a sponsor, shout out to Preston. I started reading the book. But here's the kicker. When I made that decision, that in April, I was going to get my own apartment, and I made an announcement at a meeting, or said something about it, or shared about it, and a guy at the meeting said, "Hey, my brother has a place. Are you interested?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And I don't know. I know. It's you guys. It's this book. But more importantly, it's you people. Today, and it's only been a couple months, and I don't, you know, but I'm paying my own bills. And I know that sounds like a lot of you. I come here and I would see people like Joe and all these people, and I'd admire you guys, and I see all you guys, you know, Tim, you guys paying your bills, and you got your own home, and I'm renting a room for my sister. And I got an apartment today. I paid my bills. I can't believe it, you know. And you know what I did the other, you know what I did Sunday? I fucking dusted. Right? I mean, I've been dusted, but I've never dusted. That amazed me, you know. When I cook my dinner, and I cook my dinner. When I cook my dinner, you know what I do after it? I do my dishes. And I know this. Some of y'all are like, "Oh, yeah, well, that's kind of what you're supposed to do." It's like, well, that wasn't what I did. You know, when I get my bills, I'm paying them on time. And it's only been a couple months, but, you know, the other day, I have fucking plants. And I haven't killed them yet. I'm amazed. And I've got artwork on the walls. That's my stuff. I've never done that. And everything that I'm doing today is I owe to you all. You know, I got rugs. And when I was living in that apartment, my sister was renting for me over here on East Ridgecrest Boulevard, 727 East Ridgecrest Boulevard, Apartment A. And I know there's one person here who's been in it, Kat. And how bad it was. There were a time when garbage was up over the top of the bed. There was so much garbage. There was dog and cat urine and feces all over the floor. And today, I'm growing up. And you know, we talk about miracles of the program. We talk about the promises. You know, that's a miracle, because if you've known my life and if you've seen it, you know, I've tried to pretend to be grown up before, but I never was. And it's dawning on me now that all the behavior that I've done in the past, all the manipulation, the lying, the cheating, the stealing, every time I did that, it took away that much more out of my self-esteem and how I felt about myself, and it deflated and it increased my depression. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there in my apartment the other day, and I was jumping up to do these chores. That before, it would be just, I couldn't even begin to comprehend getting up out of the chair. I couldn't even understand how to start that. My higher power today, and that's the other thing, is that my higher power, you know, we talk a lot about that here. And I want to tell people, you don't have to pick my higher power. You don't. You can pick whatever higher power works for you. And for me, and it can change. It can change. And I bet, honestly, I bet it will. All right? Because I know that when I took the whole, you know, Judeo-Christian thing at first, and I still kind of vibe to that a little bit, but I'm realizing that for me, things have changed a little bit, and I'm going to go in a different way. And again, that's this program. That's what this is teaching me. That's what you people are teaching me. But above all, you guys are teaching me to be okay with me. By sharing your stories, sharing your heart, and sharing your time. I don't know. So I just want to end with this, and that is, I want to thank all of you guys. I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. Because Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and the 12 steps have saved my life. And above all, right now, today, I honestly feel my life is worth saving. And I couldn't have said that a couple years ago. So thank you. Thank you.